WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Sedge Thompson, here for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. Touring the world and seeing American franchise restaurants and T-shirts and hearing American music may give you a sense of déjà vu, or at least the sense you've never left home. My guest, Pico Iyer, took time off as a writer for Time magazine and traveled and lived in the Far East, curious about the pervasive influence of American popular culture there. He hoped to see, in his words, which America got through to the other side of the world and which got lost in the translation. The result? His first book, called Video Nights in Kathmandu and Other Reports from the Not-So-Far East. Iyer believes American culture will persist in the Far East because it represents ideals which are unattainable in the closed and rigid societies there. The wide open spaces of the West and the hip urban attitudes of L.A. and New York will always entice without necessarily changing the underlying and ancient cultures. Iyer was born in Oxford of Indian parents. He grew up in Southern California and England. He studied at Eton, Oxford, and Harvard. I spoke with Iyer last summer following the publication of his book in paperback, and I wondered what it was he sought in his travels.
I think when I first went to the East, I was interested, as everyone is, in the exotic, in jungles and temples and mountains and whatever. And when I got there, I quickly found that together with the exotic, in and around it, were more and more things that were familiar to me. Bruce Springsteen was singing to me in Thailand, and Madonna was staring down at me in China, and enchiladas were all I could find to eat in Nepal. And so I thought that I would travel through 10 or 12 countries, seeing the different ways in which they adopted these things from the East, from the West, especially pop cultural artifacts and symbols, and the different ways they integrated them into their own cultures. And I think as I began traveling, the first thing that hit me were more and more of these anomalous or incongruous symbols and collisions. I wanted to know why it is that more people in China watch the Super Bowl than Americans, for example, or why when I got to India I found that there were six different remakes of Rambo taking place, in one of which Rambo was actually cast as a sari-clad woman, and why, for example, in Burma, a socialist country that's been closed off from the world for 25 years, when I sat down in a restaurant, I would listen to some music and it sounded a little familiar to me. And as I listened more, I realized that they were singing the whole of The Doors, Light My Fire in Burmese, in a country which has pretty much exempted itself from the rest of the world for more than a generation. So those were the kind of things that piqued my interest and curiosity when first I went there. But I think the more that I traveled, the more I was caught up in the way that that same interaction takes place on an emotional level, below the level of surfaces, that I, for example, as a relatively privileged person from California, would be drawn to the East by the notion of simplicity or a purer life or a closer touch with some ancient kind of spirit. And I would meet people in Asia, in all these countries that we regard as so blessed, wishing that they were in California and wishing that they were part of a very modern kind of fashionable trend. And I found ways in which, you know, we are obviously going over there to look for what we don't have, and we meet people who are interested only in coming to the places that we're leaving. And really, more than just a meeting or of anomalous surfaces, it became a kind of exchange of dreams.
What do you mean by an exchange of dreams?
That in the most visual form, for example, an American might be walking around Nepal wearing sandals and beads, hoping really to integrate himself into that ancient world of the High Himalayas, and he will meet a Nepali who's wearing Reeboks and a Madonna T-shirt and jeans and who wants nothing more than to integrate himself into the whole world of sort of glamour and modernity that he associates with the West. And so each is approaching the other with a mixture of fascination and ulterior motives, perhaps, that we want to project our own ideas about what these should be on certain Asian places, and they're coming to us because we're sort of symbolic carriers of America.
Mm-hmm. Being from Southern California, it seems natural, I suppose, that you would have taken a look at the Indian film industry.
which is constantly itself taking a look at California, of course.
I understand there's a film complex there called Tollywood.
Yes, everywhere I went, I heard people talking about the Indian film industry as comparable to the greatest story ever told, or the kind of big epics we were used to seeing in the 50s. As maybe you know, almost every film there is identical. It's always larger than life. There are always six songs in every movie, and it's always virtually the same plot. Handsome hero, snarling villain, and beautiful girl, all variously falling in love and out of love with one another, and finally everything comes out correctly.
What did you find when you toured these Indian movie studios? Would they emulate American films, though, in ways that startle you? You mentioned that Rambo replicas are made.
Yes, and indeed they do replicate Hollywood movies, and especially a certain kind of Hollywood movies, with a vengeance. They actually will get hold of a print of usually a fairly violent movie, a Stallone or a Chuck Bronson film, and then they will actually do a frame-by-frame reproduction, but taking it into an Indian setting. So what might be melodrama in a Stallone film becomes, I think, inadvertent comedy or something very different in India. And so they're taking these American figures and putting them in saris and Bombay apartments in the world of the black marketeers of New Delhi, and to the point where when we see Rambo reproduced in India, it's unrecognizable. And actually, I think a lot more interesting than it would be here. One of the things I found was that the products of my own culture, American culture, which are not that interesting to me here, suddenly acquired a certain kind of fascination and glamour for me when I went abroad. When I ended up in a tiny little guest house in Brunei, suddenly nothing seemed more exciting to me than watching a Burt Reynolds movie. Or when I was walking through the streets of Bangkok and I'd see Dunkin' Donuts, suddenly that too had a lure that it would never have in Los Angeles.
We were talking about how some of the cultural sounds have come back this way. I have something that I'd like you to hear that may resonate for your own ears in this way. A friend of mine was walking through Chinatown in San Francisco and stopped into a store and saw this tape, heard it playing in the store, and had to buy it. One of the great American icons, singing in the rain, sung in Cantonese with a disco beat.
Well, I think that says it much more eloquently than I could. And, for example, I found that much more charming and exciting than ever the original. It's like rediscovering the song for the first time, or well, for the second time, I suppose, but rediscovering it.
It does give a new way of listening to Singing in the Rain, no question about it. What do you think, as an observer traveling in the East, is going on here? This absorption of culture from the West overlaid to traditional culture, or is it a complete abrogation, a complete disavowal of any native culture?
No, I think you were absolutely right when you said a few minutes ago that to some extent this has been taking place for decades and really for centuries, and probably if one had gone to India 200 years ago, one would have found lots of people sipping tea and talking about polo, and in Hong Kong at least, they would have absorbed much from Europe, and in Indonesia they would be speaking Dutch. So to some extent that this is not a new phenomenon, though I think it's taking place more and more quickly as communications become quicker, as videos penetrate where books and people couldn't, as the global village gets ever smaller. But I also think that it's really taking place on mostly on the level of surfaces, and that to that extent it doesn't dent or disrupt or disturb the fundamental native culture beneath. It's comparable to if you or I were going to Asia, we might find ourselves wearing Indian shirts or at times Japanese summer kimono or whatever. But I think fundamentally, although they would affect our thinking a little and our bearing too, they wouldn't really change our values and assumptions. And I think the same works in reverse. It's particularly apparent perhaps now in Japan, where the surfaces, the coffee shops, the ice cream parlors, the bowling alleys and baseball stadiums seem relentlessly American. And yet one really feels as if one's landed on a different planet. One senses that the values and assumptions beneath all those are as alien as could be. And when one goes to the ice cream parlor and finds that the flavors are tomato or potato, or when you go to the baseball stadium and you learn that batters in Japanese baseball are told to smile when they strike out, and that the one thing that's forbidden is great individual excellence that goes against the team, you realize that something it's a fundamentally Japanese game.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, but there are exceptions to that. For instance, the influence of television, as we saw in the pro-democracy movement in China, where the influence of television substantially changed for a generation attitudes.
Yes, you're exactly right. And of course, where in China, where the demonstrators would be holding placards in English because they realized that they were addressing a universal audience, and to some extent, they wanted to address the people that they couldn't see in real life. And I think China illustrates a lot of the ambiguities and perils in this path, because it's of course a very difficult balancing act. And in some sense, what seemed to be happening in China was that they were trying to import as much as possible of foreign goods and symbols and props without the foreign values, and they found that they couldn't be divorced, that in some sense they couldn't get foreign materials without materialism, without some sense of foreign ideas and ideals, which undermined the whole thing. So it's very difficult. Certainly, I think a lot of Asian countries are probably finding that the Western or foreign goods they're bringing in are more subversive than they would like. I think in Japan at the moment, there's a great concern about what they call the Shinjinrui, which means a new breed of people, a whole new species, which are really the young people in their early 20s, comparable to our yuppies. And I think what disturbs the elder people there is a variation of what we saw in China, though of course a much quieter one. Namely, they're not so much worried that the people are wearing Chanel T-shirts and driving BMWs, as that fundamentally these goods are leading the young people towards an entirely different way of life and of thinking, that the whole Confucian notion of the family, of respect for elders, of giving all the money you have to the family, is being threatened, if not eroded, by these influences from the West, and that for the first time maybe the young are tempted to consume for themselves and consume conspicuously and go against the Japanese grain in that sense.
You talk a bit in your book about baseball and the role that baseball has now taken over in Japan. It's become a major focus. It's become the great Japanese sport. Yet it's absorbed the outside appearances of American baseball, but there's a much more corporate and indigenous quality to it. Could you explain what you saw about baseball in Japan?
One interesting thing is, as I was mentioning, that all the emphasis is on the team. And this has found a very concrete and complicated forms when they bring in American players. American players, of course, are used to showing anger, to trying to do as well as possible, and pretty much, if they're a successful player, to leading their lives as they wish. When they go to Japan, they're told they have to subordinate themselves to the team, they have to practice 8 hours a day, and that they're not to register any emotion or to argue with the umpire or the manager. And so they quickly find that Japanese baseball is a radically different thing. One interesting thing to me, too, was the crowds at a Japanese baseball game, who on one level are much more passionate than anything we'd see at Yankee Stadium or Dodger Stadium. But on the other hand, it's all the action in the stands is orchestrated. They have cheerleaders standing on the box who tell the people exactly when to shout. Everyone shouts on cue. They shout the same thing on cue. They have a set chant for every player. And they never deviate from that. So in some sense, it's kind of orchestrated chaos. It's very programmed form of wildness. And the crowd is much louder and in some ways it seems crazier than ours, but on the other hand, as with everything in Japan, it's very regimented.
You've described this phenomenon of the exchange of cultural ideas as America's pop cultural imperialism. Do you see it as an imperialism or is it an embracement?
You're quite right. My first instinct was almost to think of it as an invasion, that there are so many tourists in Bali or Tibet, that there are so many American things in Nepal or China, that we're invading them, we're making an assault on their cultural values. But what I quickly felt was, first, as mentioned, that the cultural values were still intact, and second, they were there by popular demand, and to that extent, what I first saw as a battle, a clash between Western symbols and ancient values, I finally came to see more as a love affair, a kind of hazy, mutual fascination. Because I also realized that as fast as people in China and India were devouring the symbols of Hollywood, we in the West were devouring Chinese symbols. And the kind of things that seemed so interesting to me in Japan were precisely what the Japanese would regard as exclusively for teenagers. So it is a reciprocal relation, I think. And one thing that interests me now, I think what I call the American pop culture empire seems really to be in many ways a beneficent influence. Partially it's bringing images of release and freedom and possibility to people in very straitened circumstances. And also it's just really a shorthand for what is new and exciting and dynamic. And I think the old movie makers in Hollywood, for example, really had their pulse on something universal, and that's why things American do seem to play so well all across the world. It's interesting to me now that as Japan rapidly becomes perhaps the leading economic power in the world, and all the world is consuming Japanese goods, and yet I don't think Japanese myths will ever have the same hold on hearts and imaginations that American do and have done. I think in 20 years, even if you go to India and you're finding them driving Japanese cars and Japanese stores everywhere and Japanese businessmen, I think they'll still be, in their hearts, it'll still be American songs and movies and books, videos that they're absorbing.
So the American cultural export tends to represent an ideal that is still inaccessible and probably will be in these other cultures, an ideal
exactly.
of an open society.
Precisely, which is exactly, I think, where its danger lies for the governments, especially of closed societies. I think we all know that it's famous in Russia. Every young person wants genes. And I don't think it's because they take genes to be so aesthetically winning or novel in themselves. But genes are a symbol of this other realm of freedom, and that's a way of making a political statement almost. And I think the consumption of American culture in Russia or China or Cuba, which I visited many times, is really a symbolic act, a way of trying to attach themselves to this other world. It's especially poignant, I found, in Cuba, which, of course, is 90 miles away from this country and yet seems a universe away. And when I went there, I found the people were exclusively trying to listen to Madonna and they were watching pirated American TV. And again, they had such a rosy notion of America because it was just the place that represented escape, a different system from theirs.
The idea of outside cultural influence is frightening to many countries around the world, and in part the rise of fundamentalism throughout the world sort of a counterinsurgency effort, I think, in part. Did you find signs of this in your travel? Any sort of organized effort to keep the influence of American culture out?
I think China was the most noticeable example because they were going through this kind of experiment. They would open the country to lots of Western influences and quickly realize they'd gone too far and then close back again. And so they went through these violent convulsions of trying to find the right kind of limit. But of course, prohibiting Western goods is the easiest way of making them seem attractive to a lot of people. Burma was the best example. Burma had looked around the other countries of Asia and felt that their own cultures had been corrupted, that they were now just almost satellites of America, whatever. And so Burma closed the doors to the whole outside world. But because of that, Burma lives in something of a time warp. And the young Burmese I met were more desperate than any, really, to get black market goods. A paperback copy of any American book would sell for $50. And as soon as you arrive in the airport at Rangoon, you'll meet lines, whole crowds of people waiting to buy 555 cigarettes and Johnny Walker Red. And again, I think they're really buying into the symbol. By making those goods forbidden, they'd also, the Burmese government had made them irresistible. And it was interesting to me, too, more recently, I was in Bhutan, which is perhaps the most closed country in the world. They've never had more than 2,500 tourists a year there. And every single tourist now has to pay $250 a day. So it's all but prohibitive. The country has virtually sealed its doors.
Does that include breakfast?
World. very good breakfast. And, of course, people will pay $250 a day because it's one of the last unspoiled places. And because there, the people are still living, wearing pretty much the same costumes as they were 600 years ago and living in old fortresses that haven't changed for centuries. And I found that the Bhutanese, by and large, were fairly proud of the cultural integrity that they'd preserved.
Rambo was showing, I guess it was in Indonesia when you were there, the same time of Ramayana, the great religious festival. And you said that there were more people in the movie theater than there were recognizing the religious holiday. And that included young couples and ladies who had paid the equivalent of 2 months' salary for their seats.
Yes, and I think I, as a tourist, went to see the Ramayana, the ancient dance, and most of the people watching it were tourists. To the Indonesians, Indonesian culture didn't seem so exotic or exciting, but Rambo did seem worth paying any amount of money. Rambo was everywhere when I was in Asia, and in China I think they were paying even more. It was so popular that tickets went instantly and people were playing huge amounts on the black market that in a country with a per capita income of about $300 would certainly come to several months' income. I recently heard that Rambo has now made it even to Tibet, where one of the new bars in Lhasa, which must be one of the most remote places on earth, is now the Rambo Bar.
Pico Iyer's book is Video Night in Kathmandu. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.